is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning and welcome to Medicine on Call on America's Web Radio. We're glad to have you listening in. And no, I'm not Dr. Elena George. She is stuck in some Atlanta traffic, but headed this way and should be here momentarily. It is our pleasure to have on Medicine on Call today Dr. Richard Amerling. He is Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine and is also at Mount Sinai Beth Israel Hospital, where Dr. George, I believe, had a little stint as well. Dr. Amerling is also president of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And I've known about the association, and we've had a number of their folks on. Dr. George is also a member of the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. If you don't know about them, please go to aapsonline.org. They are fighting for you, I can guarantee you. Dr. Amerling, I want to take this opportunity to thank you right off for being on. I know you have an extremely busy schedule, and I appreciate you taking this opportunity that you're giving us to be with you and listen to some of the things that you have to say. Would you like to fill in some of the holes I may have left out as far as your bio goes?
Well, I've been in practice since, I would say, 1990, really, full-time, and I've watched medicine decline since then. In the United States, did my medical school training over in Belgium during the 70s, during an incredible time over there. I had an incredibly deep education and came back to do my clinical training in the States when American medicine was still, I believe, at its pinnacle. But I've witnessed the downhill progression. You know, I'm sure many of your listeners have heard, and if you haven't, you should look into Googling Ronald Reagan's speech from the 60s, I believe it was in 63 or 64, where he talked about socialized medicine. And everything that he said in that speech, in retrospect, looks so brilliant and so prescient. He really foretold what would happen if we went down the road of socialized medicine. And of course, Medicare and Medicaid were the first big steps along that road. And both have had a very negative impact on medical care in this country. So I've seen all this happen. The centerpiece of American medical practice, I believe, has always been the personal relationship between the patient and the physician.
Amen.
And the private nature of medical care. In other words, you would go with a medical problem to a doctor who knew you and who could become your confidant and your advisor and guide you through, let's say, a serious illness. And nothing is better than that. If you're really sick, that's what you need. If you're healthy, you don't need much of anything. And I think that this has caused a lot of confusion because people who are generally healthy don't really understand the value of having a personal physician watching out for you when you're sick. And that has unfortunately led to policies that have denigrated and almost destroyed this patient-physician relationship.
Doctor, let me ask you something.
Yep.
In respect to this, do you think that the attitude and the mentality of our voting public and our and then Congress and presidents, the "I want something for nothing" has overshadowed, taken over reality of "I don't expect something for nothing. I don't mind paying for the best and working with my insurance company, my physician, my this, my that. But I don't expect something for nothing." But the fact of the matter is that it seems like those people that want something for nothing have gotten the upper hand at this point.
It does look that way. It stems from this ridiculous notion that everyone has a right to health care. Well, no, not really true. Health care, or should we say medical care, because health care in general is a term of the left, and it dissipates or makes little of, shall we say, the physician's role in treating the sick, treating illness. What we're really talking about is medical care. There is really no such thing as health care. If you're healthy, you don't need care. So this term health care should be done away with. But this issue of whether or not there's a right to health care has clouded the debate. There is no right to health care, to medical care. Medical care is a product of someone's labor, namely the physician, the nurse, and all the associated people who are providing that care. And it costs money. So you can't have a right to something that's a good and service, and then you have a right to housing, food, and of course these people believe in that too. I'm not saying that they don't.
I started to say, didn't Obama promise all that last night?
Yeah, that's right. Free everything. And of course nothing is ever free, because someone's labor has to provide for all these goodies. So for the example of medical services, medical care, we are spending literally trillions of dollars unnecessarily on care that is either not needed or unhelpful. And it's all financed through an antiquated insurance system where you are just recycling money through a third party that acts as a middleman between you and the doctor or the hospital. They siphon off their 15 to 20%. They do paperwork that costs a lot of money. They have a huge staff that costs a lot of money trying to make it harder for you to get the actual care that you need. And you're spending $15,000 or $20,000 a year for this, even though you may not be aware of it. You might just see your payroll deduction, but you know, what you don't see is the lost salary that is going towards your insurance premium. You don't see the taxes that you're paying to support this. So people have this notion that someone else is paying for their health care, when in fact they are paying for it through the nose.
How do you wake people up?
Well, I think that Obamacare is finally waking a few people up. They see their premiums jumping. These premium increases are built into the law because the law adds a whole bunch of mandates for coverage that drive up premiums, or at least create an excuse to drive up premiums. And along with the premium increases, they're seeing big increases in their deductibles, sometimes going to $3,000 or $4,000 a year. And since most people who are generally healthy maybe will spend $500 or $1,000 on medical services, that means that they're not going to even activate their insurance most years. So this money is a dead giveaway to the insurance company. It's just going right to their bottom line. And in fact, the insurance industry has had record profits this past year.
You know, let me go back and ask, are enough people waking up? Because I think the ones that have signed up for Obamacare, not to sound trivial, but it's like, I don't think they care. They just, go along.
Well, they won't really care until they understand that they're not necessarily going to actually get medical service, that they've gotten a card that doesn't have much value. There aren't going to be that many doctors who they will be able to see for the kind of money that they're getting paid. The patients who have gotten stuck into Medicaid, which is really a welfare program, are also going to find out that they don't have access to high-quality private physicians. They're going to be seeing emergency rooms. They're going to be seeing clinics. And it's not going to get them the kind of care that they really need. Now, some of them may be satisfied with that level of care. But once again, if you're really sick, it's not going to be good. And Medicaid is a very inferior form of health insurance. Patients on Medicaid, in some analyses, do worse than patients who are uninsured. If you're uninsured, you have at least the option to go and pay a doctor cash to take care of you. And that's a very reasonable approach, because medical care at the office level is very expensive. It's a good deal, especially if you've got a serious problem. You want someone who's going to pay attention to you, take the time to listen to you, figure out what's wrong, and come up with the right strategy. And you can't do that in the 5 or 6 minutes that most patients are going to get in one of these Medicaid or Obamacare practices.
Would you describe a lot of this as PA and NP type triage care that you'll be getting and not really medical care?
That is going to be a big part of it. This is the way things are going. I mean, I have only the highest respect for most NPs, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants, but they do not have the same level of care. In other words, they do not have the same training. The PA has far less training, actually, than a nurse practitioner. And nurse practitioner, though they're well-trained and they come from a nursing background, they don't have the detailed knowledge of pathophysiology, pathology, physiology that is required to be able to think creatively about a problem. So they're going to be able to work well with physicians, guiding them, and make some diagnoses and treat and do some treatments that are fairly straightforward and obvious. But anything beyond that, there are going to be problems. And as I said, it's not to belittle their performance. As I know and work with many of them, and they're very good. But think of yourself as a patient with a complex problem. Do you want a nurse practitioner with a couple of years of clinical training and maybe 1 or 2 years of experience, or do you want a physician who's had deep medical training, internship, residency, specialty, fellowship, and years of experience? I think the answer is obvious.
Absolutely, and you want it for yourself as well as for your family.
Sure.
In fact, I think even more so for your family than yourself. We are happy now to have Dr. George has made it to our round table, and it is her show, so I'll turn it all over to you all.
Thank you, and welcome, Dr. Amerling. I truly apologize. Getting here was a little bit of a challenge this morning, but thank God I'm here, and thank God you are too. I really applaud what you've been doing with AAPS, and I'm sure Dave did the introduction, and now you're the president of AAPS, which for me is the only voice that speaks for doctors, the only true voice that speaks for doctors. And I just walked in when you talked about having a nurse practitioner or a physician extender be the front line of care. I know that you know just as much about the Affordable Care Act as I do. And one of the things that underpins it is the fact that nurse practitioners, physician assistants, medical assistants are becoming the front line of healthcare. And the way the situation or system is set up, this is they're doubling down on this. This is not going to be a doctor-driven system. It's all about, teamwork and accountable care organizations. And I just saw a patient yesterday who came in with a diagnosis of an ear infection. And the person, I'm sure, that treated him was not a physician. He ended up on antibiotics. It was for 7 days. Even if he did have an infection, it wouldn't have been long enough to actually treat it. And I'm seeing people show up who are half-treated, wrong diagnosis. They've spent a lot of money, actually, these days to see these go into these clinics and these urgent cares, and it's a scam.
That's right.
I mean, you're in an academic setting, so you're fortunate. Hopefully you don't get that, too.
Oh, we get that.
Oh, wow.
Well, years ago, I started to see practice guidelines appear and proliferate. And I've been a constant critic of them, partly because they are an evil concept in a way, and partly because they're based on what is often junk science. And what I'm referring to here is what we commonly refer to as evidence-based medicine, mm-hmm. so-called evidence-based medicine. And we could have a whole discussion on that. But a lot of that stuff is based on very large population-based studies. And it's, of course, impossible to draw from those studies and make a decision about a patient who's right in front of you with their individual problem expressed through their own individual system. So this is what the nurse practitioners and physician's assistants are going to be administering. They're going to be administering what I call guideline medicine.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be following the protocols, sort of paint-by-numbers approach. And that will work for a certain number of people, but it won't work for everybody, and there will be a lot of patients harmed by this process.
I don't doubt that. Hey, let's take a break, and when we come back, I want to expound on that point, because I think people need to understand. There's so much rhetoric out there about healthcare, and I know the one thing that makes me crazed is that the people who keep speaking about it don't practice medicine. They don't have a clue, and they're the pronouncers of this is how it should be, and everybody should be happy just to get a crumb. So well, let's talk more about that when we come back.
Yeah, you're listening, John Gruber.
Oh God, that's number one.
Okay, I'm going to change location. I'll call you back as soon as I get to my new spot. I'm in the middle of a biopsy.
Okay, perfect.
Okay, talk to you soon.
All right, you're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps, a chronic sinus infection, or allergies that are either undertreated or have never been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we use state-of-the-art equipment so you can see the problem. You'll be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment, because we believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. We specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery, correction of a nasal septal deviation, and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office, getting you back to work the next day. And you can rest assured that all options will be discussed before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that dizziness may be a sign of heart disease, iron deficiency, high or low blood pressure, low blood sugar, or an inner ear infection? Dizziness can take the form of a spinning sensation, also known as vertigo, or a feeling of lightheadedness. The individual can also feel faint or have a rapid heartbeat. If you take high blood pressure medication, remember to take the medication daily as directed to control your blood pressure. Diabetics must remember to eat after taking their medication and to eat at regular intervals. If you have anemia, make sure to take a multivitamin that contains iron and to eat vegetables such as spinach. Dizziness after a cold or flu may be due to a virus. If you have dizziness, it is important to see your doctor for a complete physical examination. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. While we're waiting for Dr. Amerling to call in, I just wanted to backtrack on what he said about the fact that medicine has changed, where we're not talking about physicians that are trained as patient advocates anymore. I'm sure we'll go over it in more detail. But this is a learning show for people, for patients, potential patients, that you really have to be savvy about who you choose and where you go to get health care. We're now seeing a position where it's so expensive now for patients to go to doctors who operate and see patients and their employees of the hospital. Those doctors have the least amount of power over their patients' care because they are driven, like Dr. Amerling said, by using algorithms. You know, this is a top-down approach, a centralized approach to healthcare, where you have committees that decide how to treat somebody, what an outcome should be, how long it should take to get to the outcome, and if you don't fall within those parameters, then this is the difference. The problem or the fault lies with the doctor. No matter what, it's not that the patient decided to go to McDonald's. It's not that they decided to not take their medication. It's not ever driven by reality. It's driven by what they say reality should be. It reminds me of last night's State of the Union. That was an exercise in alternate reality. I've never heard so many pronouncements about how fabulous things are and how we're doing so well. It was It was interesting to listen to, must say. And Dr. Ameling is rejoining us.
Hi, Elena.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
I don't want to segue too far, but last night's State of the Union was, I just said, an exercise in alternate reality. If you didn't live in this country in the real world, you would think that everything was hunky-dory, wouldn't you? It was amazing.
I know. It was lies and disinformation, real good old Marxist agitprop.
It's what I say. Reality is what I say it is. And that's what it really was last night. It's incredible. So I want to go back to what we said at the break about the, you know, the fact that healthcare is now, it's driven by cookie cutter conveyor belt medicine. But what I think people need to understand, yes, they're big studies, but who underwrites them? You know, they're not being paid for by private means. They're being paid for by the same drug companies that tell you that their drug should be used as the drug of choice for whatever medical problem you have. I mean, there's so many fingers in this pie and on this scale to push it in their direction that it doesn't really, it's fake, basically.
No, it's true. It's true. The industry, pharmaceutical industry in particular, dominates the medical literature. I mean, if you open up any journal, you see these sponsored studies.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you only see the ones that are favorable. The ones that are unfavorable, they don't have an obligation to publish.
No.
And so that, so they base these guidelines on the literature, the database, which is corrupt. Then it's all these big population studies where a minuscule clinical benefit gets amplified into a statistically significant difference. A relative risk reduction, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
in the incidence of a heart attack or a stroke, that has no clinical relevance, but it's statistically significant because they have tens of thousands of patients enrolled.
It's true. And then they find out down the road, it's just like a conveyor belt of outcomes here, because the trial lawyers then get involved with the class action suit when they find out that the medication really wasn't all that safe and really did cause a problem. I mean, the list is endless. It's, you know... But
yeah.
The power lies with the doctor and the patient, don't you agree? Why are doctors lemmings? Why do we write these prescriptions just because somebody says it's the next new thing when we know that, one, it's going to be prohibitively expensive, and two, maybe taking it once a day should not benefit. You know, it's not worth spending three times more to take the same thing once a day. Nothing's new, really. It's just medicines that are two medicines put together, three medicines put together, and they make a new name, and it's once a day. That's what they're doing now.
Yeah, and I know. It's crazy, this whole concept that people are taking medications for life is bizarre. Most of the patients that I see a ton of patients with high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes, most of these conditions are treatable by diet and exercise without medication. But most of the medical world is committed to giving them medicine for life, and these medicines often make them worse.
Well, I'm going to ask you I hope not a tough question, but I'm just curious. You are an academic physician. You are, you know, head of a department. You're running in one of the major hospitals in the whole country. Is there any pressure on you? Because you are somebody who thinks outside the box. You are a patient advocate. Are they putting any pressure on you to toe a line? I'm just curious.
Well, in terms of they do force everybody now to use an electronic health record.
Yeah.
And that is increasingly an irritant and an impediment to good care. So that's one major area that is unfortunately meant there very little I can do about staying in this environment.
And from your colleagues, what's their take on the fact that you are and you're outspoken? You just people know where you stand, I'm sure. Are you getting any pushback from them, or are they now seeing that, hey, you're right, we need to actually get involved now and really be proactive about our patient care? Is that happening at all?
I think that they're giving me some... I haven't had any pushback in a long time. Many years ago, I published an op-ed in a dialysis newspaper that was responding to... hold on one second. There's a truck passing by. It's very loud. I'll be inside in a second.
Okay.
responding to a series of articles that were really yellow journalism, impugning the integrity of the for-profit dialysis companies. Now, there are some issues there, but it's not as though we're trying to kill patients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no profit in that even. So I put out an op-ed that sort of blasted the Times, and the Times contacted the hospital, and they were very bent out of shape, which convinced me that I was on the mark.
Oh, man. I mean...
But I have not had any pushback from the administration. You know, Mount Sinai, as you know, just took over our hospital about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and they're still in the process of integrating it. So perhaps I haven't really come up on their radar at this point. But nothing that I'm saying is incompatible with good medical practice. In fact, just the opposite. I'm pushing back on what I think is a very bad aspect of medical practice, such as accountable care organizations and treating by numbers. So I hope that they are willing to take that as constructive criticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anything we can do now before this locks down is going to be a blow for freedom. I don't know if you saw this article, but there was a recent article I just picked up yesterday that says that the healthcare.gov site, which I wrote about maybe about a year and a half ago, that
yep.
it's not private and that actually your data can be mined for advertisers. And your data that you put in goes to Google, Facebook, Twitter. They're also doing metadata on your information, and they can literally track you. You know, your age,
yeah.
your sex, whether you smoke, all sorts of things about you that it should never, ever be fair game for anybody who's not a physician.
I know.
Do patients have a clue about this at all?
They don't. They don't. No, the mandatory computerization and meaningful use stuff is a gross violation of confidentiality. I don't think this data is at all private.
And meaningful use, for our listeners, can you tell them what that is?
Well, you know, there is nothing inherently wrong with an electronic health record, but you could make one yourself on an iPad without any trouble. You
mm-hmm.
could make one on an iPhone
mm-hmm.
And keep everything electronic. But what really is the reason behind the push for the electronic health record, beyond, of course, enriching various companies involved with IT, is this need for data. So meaningful use is the reporting of clinical data, such as smoking history and things like that,
mm-hmm.
to the powers, to the payers, to the insurance companies, and to the government. And there is no way that this data can remain strictly confidential once it's reported, in my view. Plus, it's vulnerable to hacking.
Yep.
And there have been instances already of this.
Absolutely. And we're talking about data that's really sensitive. I mean, whether or not you've had, you know, let's get down, a sexually transmitted disease, or whether you've done recreational drugs, things that really nobody's business outside of you and your doctor could potentially be used against you, whether you have, I mean, I'm seeing questions about whether you've had a gun in your home, whether you ever tried to hurt yourself. I mean, they're getting into questions that someone can just extrapolate the way they want to. Hey, this person has had a depression medication. They have a gun in their home. Next thing you know, you're swatted. I mean, you just don't know how the data will be used against you.
That's right. And even the fact that you're being pushed to even ask these questions that are irrelevant to most of what you're going to be seeing the patient
mm-hmm.
about is a gross intervention and kind of destroys the patient-physician relationship right off the bat.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And let's be clear to the patients. When you say meaningful use, some of these electronic medical records, you cannot close the chart until you answer these questions. So it's not like you can say, you know, not applicable or skip them when you're a physician, when you're doing the patient medical record.
Right.
You have to follow it. Otherwise, it keeps flagging and it won't close. So they actually tie the doctor into roping the doctor into this system, too, and being an agent for the system.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they ultimately are going to be trying to guide treatment. You're going to have to click on buttons and tabs to get through an algorithm to show that you've measured blood pressure, that you've gotten a pressure reading of a certain amount, and they're going to be monitoring physician performance this way, and then penalizing you if you don't come up with the right numbers.
That's what I said while you were off the phone, is that it's never, whatever happens in terms of a bad outcome is never going to be patient-centered or reality check. It's going to be because the doctor didn't do something. It's always the doctor's fault. It's our liability no matter what now. And I think that is so chilling. Nobody would want to be a doctor if you've got someone sitting on your shoulder telling you you're not good enough, you didn't follow, you didn't toe the line. I mean, that is just, I have no words for it.
That's right. We're going to take the heat for any bad outcome.
Absolutely. Hey, on that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine On Call.
When I call you back, it will be from a landline.
Okay.
Okay. All right, Elena.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that sleep is an important weapon against infection? Sleep is important because it is restorative. During sleep, known as REM, the body recuperates and resets. For example, the immune system increases its activity and stress hormones drop. There is a correlation between sleep deprivation and frequent colds. The average adult should get 7 to 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep per night, and a child needs more since they are growing. Sleep hygiene is important to set a good foundation. Techniques to promote good quality restorative sleep include going to bed at the same time at night, avoiding alcohol or caffeine prior to bedtime, avoiding exercise in the evening, reading to a young child at bedtime, avoidance of drinking fluids late in the evening, and avoidance of taking decongestants at bedtime. If you are having problems sleeping more than once a week, you should see a doctor for further evaluation. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure? Do other people smell things that you don't? Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps, a chronic sinus infection, or allergies that are either undertreated or have never been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we use state-of-the-art equipment so you can see the problem. You'll be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment, because we believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. We specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery, correction of a nasal septal deviation, and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office, getting you back to work the next day. And you can rest assured that all options will be discussed before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. While waiting for Dr. Amling to call in for our third segment, I was just talking with the producer in the break, and again, going back to that State of the Union, it was interesting that the people who did the focus groups afterwards got it. I mean, they saw what I'm sure most people who are in the real world saw, that everything that was said about healthcare and all these people joining it and how fabulous it is, the actions and the rhetoric really don't match. I think this has been one of the most divisive times in our country recently, in the last 6 years. Everybody's pitted against everybody. Doctors against doctors, specialists against primary care. You've got doctors against patients. You've got, forget the race card, that's just crazed. And we've got rich against poor. We've got middle class against, basically against everybody, because the middle class is the one really footing the bill and bearing the brunt of everything that's been going down. I think now we need some sort of Rosetta Stone for what they say and what really happens. So when they tell you that, there's so many more people partaking of health care and Affordable Care Act is working and it's lowering the cost, what they really mean is people have been forced to buy this crap and they can't afford to use it because their out-of-pockets are so high. That's why the costs have come down. That's reality. And when they tell you how fabulous it is in the UK and we should want to do their system and we have the worst outcomes and it's not right and fair, the UK is now on the brink of collapsing. There's an article that showed up about the National Health Service, and the person who runs it said that if they don't change what they do, they will not have a National Health Service where they can give free care for everybody because it's so expensive. That's what we're trying to emulate, really? I know, Dr. Emmerling, you're back on the line, right?
Elena, yes, hi.
Did you see the article from the National Health Service of Britain that said that the person who runs it, the doctor, said if they don't change what they're doing, they will not be able to afford to give everybody universal health care? And this is the system that all these proponents of Obamacare are like, oh, we need to do what the UK is doing. You know, Europe has it down. You know, we're not running a fair system. We have worse outcomes. Those people wait forever to get surgery. I remember when I used to read about this, if you were of a certain age, you did not get care, right? You didn't get the hip replacement. You didn't get the cataract surgery because you were too old.
Right. Well, they're NICE, which is the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which is the ultimate euphemism, is a rationing board, and this is what the IPAB, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, was modeled after. And their job is to decide what procedures, what drugs are going to be paid for, and how much things are going to be paid, so they can have complete control over what services are provided just by adjusting the price.
Absolutely. I mean, and they do
and
that
of course,
here.
They take into account how old you are. You know, the idea that how many quality life years, the qualies, how many quality life years do you have left? And they value each quality at a certain level, let's say $20,000 or $30,000 or pounds. And if you don't have enough qualies to justify the procedure in terms of money, you don't get it.
That's what we really want to emulate, really, people? I don't think so. I mean, we're already seeing that with some of the cancer drugs in Medicare. Avastin and things like that that got stuck. They stopped covering that about 2 years ago, and it was because the outcome wasn't worth the cost. You know what? If I had a disease that could help me, that's worth the cost for me. I mean, they make
it
sound like people in Medicare are just getting freebies. Those guys, we all who work, pay for that. So you pay into a system. I think you deserve to get money back for what you put in. But these people are like, it's a freebie, you're just glomming on the system, you're a leech, and you should just go away and die.
Right.
That's their attitude. We should be up
That's
in arms
right.
by that.
But, you know, it's insurance turned upside down because they will pay gladly for routine care that they consider inexpensive, but which ultimately cost far more than the extraordinary care. So they'll pay for everybody in the country, if not the world, to get a statin and some other and high blood pressure medication, though they don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
And that costs billions and billions of dollars a year. But they won't pay for you to get a hip that will improve your quality of life, or they won't pay for you to get a cabbage that will give you extra years. The things that are expensive, the big item, the big ticket items, they make it very hard for you people to get. And that should be what they pay for. They should let the average use, you know, the everyday stuff, everyday expenses, we should pick up.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, believe me, if people had to actually pay for their statin, I don't think that many people would be taking them, frankly.
No, I think they'd be on a treadmill, actually. Talk about will, you know. And also, the statins have been shown to cause more disease. I mean, heart attacks, strokes, they don't decrease with the statins. You actually have medical problems that the statins create, liver disease, liver failure, that sort of thing.
Right,
I mean,
right. Plus the almost universal the myopathy. People develop aches and pains that are entirely related to the statin drug. I mean, they're very toxic when you think about it.
And I told my patient yesterday, everything that we prescribe for you is a controlled poison. You know, you have to be within a certain parameter that it's safe to use, but honestly, there really isn't anything except something, even nature, if you do things that are natural, you overdo it, it's toxic. So maybe we should really take a step back, and I see patients now every day that get it, and that don't want to take a medication, want to fix the problem, and it's much cheaper for an ENT, for example, to treat an allergy with a sublingual under-the-tongue immunization, which may last for maybe 2 to 3 years, than to take Nasonex or Zyrtec or whatever antihistamine you want to name for 30 years? Which one would you rather take when you think about the long-term cost-benefit-risk ratio?
Yeah, it's true. And there was recently a little bit of a flap about these new drugs that cure hepatitis C.
Oh, yeah.
Now, hepatitis C is a devastating disease that is ultimately fatal in many patients, causes liver cancer and cirrhosis. And these drugs that have come out recently have a high cure rate, and they cost $100,000 for a year of treatment, which is trivial when you think about how much money is spent on Abilify, let's say, which is like the highest cost, the biggest ticket item now in the country, and does absolutely no good to almost anybody, and probably is bad for them. But they balk about spending $100,000 for a patient for a cure of a deadly disease that is also going to save them tons of money down the line in terms of hospitalizations and surgery. I mean, it's just bizarre.
Well, you know, that's what happens when you don't have doctors running a system, where you don't have doctors who are practicing running a system.
Right.
I mean, let's look at the ERs, for example, the amount of waste and cost to the patient on unnecessary testing. I can't tell you how many CT scans I've been told about for quote-unquote peritonsillar abscess. It's a waste of money putting the patient in harm's way with radiation that they don't need because you can't make a clinical diagnosis. We would save so much money if we had the right clinician on the front line. I think that ER board certified doctors should be in the ER. I don't believe that family practice, God, don't, go after me, but family practice should be in the office, not in an ER, on the front line.
And of course, this is an obvious source of waste. Things that could easily be handled by a competent internist or even family practice doctor in an office setting end up costing thousands and thousands of dollars for an ER visit. That should have been avoided in the first place.
Exactly.
But that is what the system is pushing us to, because it's increasingly impossible to maintain an office with the crummy payments you're getting from the insurers and from the government.
Oh, well, let's talk about that bait and switch. You know, the doctors who are proponents of Obamacare and universal health care, Medicare for all, we're all excited about taking money from specialists, and whether they be medical specialists like yourself, nephrologists or ENTs or whatever, and giving it to primary care. Now it turns out the government is going to cut the fees for primary care by a quarter. So they're actually going to end up making less. They got their boon to get on board and be the mouthpiece. Now they're going to get the rug pulled out from them. And it's not going to stop. I understand, I was at the AAPS meeting that we're going to have 25% decrease over the next in payment to everybody, right? Over the next, 10 years or something? It's 2% a year or 1% a year that it drops. They're going to put doctors in a position that we have nowhere to go except into a hospital as an employee, because we cannot keep a practice open because it's not sustainable economically.
That's right, and that has been going on, and we know that the number of physicians in private practice has declined from about two-thirds to one-third over the past 5 years, and that trend is going to continue. It has to, because of the cost equation and the lousy business model of your costs going up every year and your reimbursements going down. That's obviously unsustainable. You don't need an MBA to see that. And that's by design. They're pushing doctors into a hospital setting where they can better be controlled, and they are being controlled.
That's the sad part. And the access to patients is going down because they can't, especially rural, let's talk about them, they're closing those hospitals left and right. They've either become big system players where they've been, bought out by major corporation hospitals or the biggest game in town, and they're shutting the competition down. This is the essence of where we are, I think, as a country and globally. We have a corporate-driven system centralizing that does not want competition. They don't want free thinkers. They don't want anybody who's independent and has a thought in their head. They want to drive everybody out, because it makes their system the only game, and they can be as inefficient as, if you don't like it, you can go and die somewhere. They can do that all day long when they don't have any opposition that someone can say, I can find something better somewhere else. As long as people cannot say that, then they win. So we need to, you and I are doing what we're supposed to do. But I challenge the patients as well to start educating themselves, be proper consumers, and it starts from everything you put in your mouth to every every school you want to put your child into, to everything that you do, you now have to do it with intention. It can no longer be going with the, you know, the detritus. You know, that's ebbing and flowing, and people are telling you should love how crappy this is, and it's awesome. You shouldn't go with that at this point. On that note, let's take a small break and finish up. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
This is Dr. George from Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center. We've won patient care awards and have the highest patient recommendations because I believe in practicing medicine the old-fashioned way. Practicing good medicine is based in listening to the patient and making a care plan that is individualized. The best medical care is given when there is a strong doctor-patient relationship built on mutual trust and respect. At Peachtree ENT Center, we believe in taking care of the whole patient because healing is more than writing a prescription. Whether you have problems hearing or your child has frequent throat infections, from the time you call our office and speak to a real person, you will be treated as an individual, not an ailment. During your visit, you will not be rushed, and all of your questions will be answered. And when possible, I will recommend natural treatments to fix the problem. If surgery is recommended, cost-effective, minimally invasive treatment for snoring, sleep apnea, or sinus problems will be offered, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts. If you'd like to make an appointment, call 404-591-9100 or reach us on the web at www.peachtreeentcenter.com.
Have you tuned in to the Master Gardener Hour lately? We have a brand new look. Come and join me, the new host, Kate Copsey, every Saturday at 11 a.m. on America's Web Radio.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know skipping doses of medication can be dangerous? If you have a chronic medical condition like diabetes or high blood pressure, it's important to take the medication prescribed by your physician. It is also important to remember that although you take a medicine to treat a condition, it is not a cure for the underlying medical condition. It is used to control it. For example, taking medication for diabetes will lower your blood sugar. However, if you stop taking the medication, the sugar will rise again. Changes in both diet and lifestyle, like adding exercise to your routine, are equally important. Working with your physician by following his or her recommendations is the key to controlling your disease and maintaining your health. Ask questions if you don't understand something. Taking control of your health is the key to wellness. Please join me Wednesdays at 9 a.m. for Medicine on Call. This is Dr. Elena George.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. You know, part of a live show, it's never boring. So, you know, we have a lot of moving parts, and, you know, ultimately it's all about getting you information. So Dr. Amerling is rejoining us because he's, you know, we're blessed to have him in his workday come in and share his wealth of knowledge. And, you know, Dr. Amerling, I want you to be a little bit of a give us a crystal ball of what you think, from your perspective, how this is going to play out now for doctors. There's been a lot of, you know, conjecture about whether our licensure will be tied to taking Medicare or taking Obamacare. That would be the death blow for the healthcare profession. I mean, it's already teetering. That would just be the last slice or the last stab wound. Do you see that happening, or is there any way to be
Well, that's what I wrote in my somewhat satirical State of My Union op-ed that went out this week, which is that is the ultimate goal of the powers that be, and that's, of course, the administration plus the medical-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
They would like this incredible gravy train to keep running, spewing out the trillions of dollars that go into it every year, much of it waste. And to do that, they need a compliant medical profession. And how do you make the doctors compliant? Well, first you put them into a hospital setting.
Mm-hmm.
But then also you make licensure contingent on them playing along. So the one thing that is protecting doctors is the fact that medical licensure is handled at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
It's a state-by-state function. So for the federal government to take over that aspect of medicine would involve a gross violation of federalism and powers of the state. So what they are first trying to do is coerce doctors or con them into a federal licensing scam.
In other words, having one central license that would be good in all the states. And the fig leaf for this is telemedicine, the idea that you're going to be able to do telemedicine and take care of patients all over the country from whatever state you live in. You need a federal license. And, of course, that federal license is going to require that you maintain certification, which is, of course, the big scam that we talked about at the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But the transfer of authority for medical licensure from states to the federal government would be the beginning of the end. At that point, they can make licensure hinge on compliance and taking whatever insurance payments they're going to give.
Wow. So we have to definitely fight. Is there something that AAPS is doing from a legislative or legal perspective to blunt that?
Yeah, we are. We have two things going on. One is we have a lawsuit challenging the American Board of Medical Specialties for their monopoly control over certification,
mm-hmm.
and the whole maintenance of certification scam that does nothing to increase value for the patients or the physicians but costs a lot of money and time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are also opposing the Federation of State Medical Boards creating this interstate compact, which will be the first step towards a federal licensing system for medicine.
Well, those are two really important steps. I think also that, you know, I've been on sites like Sermo, which is another, you know, basically a bulletin board for doctors to air their interests. And there was one article that I thought that was really kind of telling with the mindset. And he's like, oh, we should just stop whining about maintenance of certification because it's here and we have other bigger things to fight. In my opinion, there's no other bigger thing to fight than maintenance of certification. If you're spending
right.
all your time studying for a test that's non sequitur and you can't practice in a hospital or really be a patient advocate because you're always under duress, then they've just taken you out of the game. You can't
yep.
be. And, I mean, who would think that that's a good thing? I don't know anybody who has to do that who's happy
no
about
one.
It. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I passed my boards ages ago. I've grandfathered out of it. I don't have to do maintenance certification. Are they trying to rescind that where you no and longer can grandfather?
Yes.
That
eventually,
is crazy.
Yes. I am grandfathered in too, but eventually they're going to go after everybody. We have to push back not only against maintenance and certification, but against all these attempts by non-doctors and elites to control the way practicing physicians work. And we talked about this earlier, the PhDs who are ruining medical care, Jonathan Gruber being the latest,
mm-hmm.
but before him there was William Hashaw, who created the relative resource-based relative value scale, which is a Soviet-inspired system of relative work value for physicians, and that was a huge blow against practice of medicine. And these PhDs are destroying the practice of medicine, and they know nothing about it.
How do we limit them? I mean, is there a way to limit them? I mean, part of it to me is to educate the patient. They need to understand that maintenance of certification doesn't mean your doctor is bad if they don't do
right.
that.
Right.
Somebody told me that the hospitals are really trying to proactively go out there and demean doctors who don't do maintenance of certification. Like they're trying to make a PR blitz of, if your doctor doesn't have, there's something wrong with your doctor. I think they should be sued for something like that, for
yeah.
restriction of trade, for libel.
Yeah.
I would
right.
go after them if they tried that.
Well, but that's where AAPS has a role, because our legal strategy is looking at all these things. There is an alternative board now has been set up by Paul Tierstein, who wrote the editorial in the New England Journal a couple of weeks ago against maintenance of certification. And if people certify with their board, which is less expensive and doesn't require an exam,
mm-hmm.
then we can, and then they present their certification in a credentialing process, say at a hospital, if they get turned down, well, that's the basis for a lawsuit. You know, who granted the ABMS an exclusive contract
mm-hmm.
in this area? Are they immune to any competition? It's ridiculous.
And this goes down to exactly what the show's about. The power is in the individual. You know, it's in the individual doctor to stand up and say, I'm worth, you don't get to define me. And that's for the patient as well, to say something like that. Or they don't want, if you want to have a hip replacement, or you want to have your doctor perform procedure on you, who is the insurance company who you pay a premium to? or the government for that matter, who you've paid in with your sweat and blood working mm-hmm. from the time you were 16, maybe in some ages, you know, to 65 or whatever, to tell you that you can't have something. That's where you need to stop. You know, I don't want anybody to tell me what my limit is. Nobody has the right to tell me that. And if I don't, if they do that, I will walk away from the table. If mm-hmm. doctors and patients did that, this system would fall apart.
It would
stop. I don't want
that's our final line in the sand, which is to walk away from all third-party contracts.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've been pushing for over 10 years in the Physician's Declaration of Independence. If enough doctors do this, then the system is going to have to change, or they're going to have to make do without us in some way. And that's our ultimate last line of defense. And we're getting to the point where this is all we have left.
It's true. I think we've played the game and we've made the best of a bad situation for the last 20 years.
Right.
And it started off with dropping our reimbursements and then saying, mm-hmm. okay, I'll see more patients. Dropping our, you know, making us go through a gatekeeper. Okay,
right.
I'll hire people to work the system.
Right.
We've fed the beast. And
mm-hmm.
now we're going to be replaced by people who are 2 years training, people
mm-hmm.
coming from foreign medical schools who are happy to get a crumb, who will do like, I'll pull a plug, I got no problem.
Right.
I got a job. You do not want that person to be your physician. Trust and believe. They will. They're not working in your interest.
Right.
They're just going to handle, they're going to do them. That is against the Hippocratic Oath. And I've had
right.
Dr. Orion on, who told me people don't even do the Hippocratic Oath in some medical schools.
No, they've bastardized it anyway.
Oy. Just sad.
No, there's a real conflict of interest there when doctors are working for a third party as opposed to the patient. And that's going to be increasingly the state of affairs.
Well, that's as long as there's direct pay, as long mm-hmm. as there's doctors like you and I who really do follow the Hippocratic Oath,
mm-hmm.
patients will need to flock to us so that we can save them.
That's what we hope.
I think ultimately, everything that you do has power. And I think everything, thank God you're here and you're part of APS, AAPS, and you're working on behalf of me and my patients. How can people contact you?
Well, AAPS Online has all the information, contact information, lots of useful information, various op-eds by myself and others in our organization. And we're so glad that you are doing what you're doing. Believe me, you're a huge and powerful voice out there. And keep it up, and eventually we will get through.
Well,
we hope.
Well, I'm going to do everything I can, just like you, and I'm happy that I'm really happy that we're on the same side.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to thank you so much. I know you were busy this morning, and I really appreciate you taking the time to be with me.
Elena, great talking with you. Anytime.
All right. Have a great day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And thank you for your listening to Medicine on Call, and we'll be back next week.
This is America's AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.